The Tom Woods Show, episode 445.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey everybody, Tom Woods here, reminding you that you can get one of my books as an audiobook for free at tomwoodsaudio.com. You could get my New York Times bestsellers Meltdown on the Financial Crisis, featuring a foreword by Ron Paul, and The Politically Incorrect Guide to American History, or Nullification, or Rollback, or my latest book with me reading it, Real Dissent. Check it out at tomwoodsaudio.com. Welcome, everybody. Today, we're going to talk about egalitarianism and calls for equality. Equality in a material sense, not just equality before the law or any of these more modest calls for equality, but the more sweeping calls for equality that we hear from the left. And in particular, we want to talk about the political philosopher John Rawls, who is very significant, and you'll get more background on him in just a minute. But these are arguments that I think will help you when you confront people who want more equality, or who believe that equality of material condition is some kind of moral ideal toward which we ought to be striving. Can you really have a society based on such a principle? So we're going to look at that. And the way we're going to do it is I'm actually going to play for you now one of the lessons from the government course that I did for the Ron Paul homeschool curriculum. So in case you're curious about what that material is like, here's an example. Now, this one is a little on the longer side. They're not all, they tend to be around 25 minutes. This one's a little bit longer than that. What I'm doing is I'm stripping out the first few minutes of the lesson, because in the first few minutes, I review the previous lesson. That's what helps people retain information, is constant review. Well, since you didn't hear the previous lesson, it wouldn't really make any sense for me to do that review, so I'm clipping that. But the rest of it is as is. This is a lesson that I'm doing in my high school course on government. I think you will see after listening to this episode that I've been telling you the truth when I say that these courses can be taken profitably by adults as well. I am not in any way talking down to the students, even though from time to time I do make sure that I define a word that they're not likely to know or that I haven't used yet in the course. Now, on the show notes page for today, tomwoods.com/445, you will find out how to get this course. I'll tell you right now how to get it, but so you don't have to jot all that down. It's at tomwoods.com/445. You can get it, first of all, at tomwoods.com/government. You just look at, you can see all 90 lessons listed there at tomwoods.com/government. And then you will see links for how to get the course a la carte, just this one course. And you'll see a link for how to get it through the Ron Paul curriculum, how to join the Ron Paul curriculum and get the whole curriculum, which would include this course. Now, remember, make sure if you do join the Ron Paul curriculum, you'd be crazy not to join it through my special link, which is ronpaulhomeschool.com. Enter the site through ronpaulhomeschool.com, and then when you go on to join, you get two freebies, The Politically Incorrect Guide to American History, my New York Times bestseller, signed to you and mailed to you, and also a free 10-lesson bonus course on the foundations of liberty. So make sure if you join the Ron Paul curriculum, join it through ronpaulhomeschool.com, and then just drop me a note at tomwoods.com/contact, and I'll get you those freebies. And of course, you can get these courses as gold and platinum members of the Supporting Listeners program of this show at supportinglisteners.com, but all that will be explained and linked over at tomwoods.com/445, the show notes page for today. All right, everybody, here we go. I hope you enjoy it. Hi, everybody, it's Tom Woods, and today we're going to talk about a very, very influential 20th century political philosopher named John Rawls. I think Rawls, of the ones this week, other than Rousseau, Rawls would be the one who's the best known. But it's pretty good, I think, for somebody, especially somebody your age, to be acquainted with these names. You will have a big leg up. If you ever take political thought, you'll be way, way ahead of the game, because no other kid will know these names. They might not even know John Rawls. John Rawls, let me look on the slide here, the word egalitarianism. That's a huge word. Egalitarian egalitarianism is a commitment to equality, the idea of equality. Now, to some degree, of course, a liberal, a classical liberal or libertarian, believes in a form of equality,
believes that everybody has an equal right not to be killed, not to have his property taken away, etc. In that sense, everybody is equal. Everybody is equally entitled to not be interfered with. But that's as far as the classical liberal or libertarian would go. But when we use the word egalitarian, we usually mean something beyond just that. An egalitarian is somebody who often believes, at the very least, that incomes, that is the amount of money you earn, should be made more equal than it is now. So people who are rich should have a little bit less. People who are poor should have a little bit more. And an extreme or radical egalitarian would believe that everybody should have absolutely equal amounts of income and wealth. Now, Rawls does not hold that everybody has to have exactly the same amount of wealth or income, but we'll see why he says that in just a minute. But let's first go through and try and understand a little bit about Rawls. The key book that everybody knows about in connection with Rawls is his book, A Theory of Justice, from 1971. What's particularly interesting about this book is that it contains no definition of justice. This is rather an oversight for a philosopher. Philosophers are supposed to believe in defining terms and being super precise. We never get a definition of what he even means by justice. Until page 579. Page 579, he at least acknowledges that he hasn't defined justice. He says that he was eager, quote, to leave questions of meaning and definition aside and get on with the task of developing a substantive theory of justice. So he doesn't have time to define justice. He has to get on with the task of establishing a theory of something he won't define for us. Well, that's where we start off with this. All right, now with some of these bullet points, the text is going to be a little small, so I'm going to ask you to use the little rectangle on your screen. In the lower right-hand corner, you'll see a little rectangle. Just click on that, and that'll make this slide, and this, of course, works with all these videos of the Ron Paul curriculum, take up the whole computer screen. You'll be able to read it a little bit better. And by the way, don't worry, I'm going to read them to you. But if you want to follow along, what Rawls is best known for is his thought experiment. And he later says that he devised the experiment in such a way that it would have the outcome that he wanted. But here's how the experiment works. He's saying, let's imagine that you are in what he calls the original position. You are going to be part of a society, but you are operating under what he calls a veil of ignorance. So you don't know in this society what your position is going to be. You don't know if you're going to be male or female. You don't know if you're going to be rich or poor. You don't know if you're going to be black or white. You don't know if you're going to be talented or untalented. That turns out to be a very important issue for Rawls. And you are in this original position in a situation at which, to quote Rawls, the chief primary goods at the disposition of society are rights and liberties, income and wealth. So in other words, you're in the following position. You don't know who you're going to be. You don't know what place in society you're going to occupy. And you exist in some kind of realm in which all goods are available to be distributed according to whatever principle you devise. So let's consider what you would be likely to think according to Rawls. You're in this situation. You're trying to think of what would be the rules that I would want society to be guided by if I don't know who I'm going to be in that society. Now, if I knew I was going to be really, really rich and powerful, maybe I might say, well, the best law would be that everybody has to work for the rich people, or the rich people get to keep all their money. But I don't know who I'm going to be. Maybe I won't be rich. Maybe I'll be the lowest of the low. And so Rawls therefore presumes that you will be risk averse. That is to say, that you won't want to roll the dice and take a chance that you're going to be the worst of the worst without preparing yourself for that. In other words, let's imagine, for example, some kids and one of them, they're at a birthday party and the birthday boy is going to cut the cake. Now, let's suppose he doesn't know who will be assigned which slice of the cake. How should he slice the cake? Now, he could slice a giant piece of the cake and hope that he gets that one. But probably, the odds are he won't. So he'll probably wind up with one of the tiny pieces that he had to cut because he made the other one so big. So instead, he is likely to say, well, I think probably the safest way to go is to cut the cake into equal pieces. So I won't have any less than anybody else. Might not have any more than anybody else, but at least I won't be the, if I'm the lowest of the low, we're all the lowest of the low together. Equality would be probably the principle that the, on which the kid would decide how he's going to cut that cake. Well, Rawls is going to say that that's going to be the principle that you're going to come up with when you're trying to sort of cut the cake of society, as it were. When you're trying to decide what society do I want to live in if I don't know who I am in that society? Well, I don't want to take any chances, he thinks we'll say. So let's just have a rule that everybody should be equal. And then I don't have to worry about being the lowest of the low because we're all equal. He thinks that's what you are likely to decide if you are impartial, you're behind a veil of ignorance, you don't have any vested interests, you don't know that you're rich or poor, you don't know if you're going to be, I mean, again, maybe you might turn out to be really talented, and you might want to say, the rule is that the talented people should get a lot of money. But what if you turn out to be untalented? Then you would, maybe you might not like that rule. So this rule, he thinks, is the one that we would all say, well, I think this is the best. This protects me against the worst possible outcome. Let's just say equality. So Rawls concludes that there are two principles that we decide upon behind the veil of ignorance. One of them is equal liberty. He thinks that we will believe in the principle of liberty, that everybody should have as much liberty as possible as long as he doesn't interfere with the liberty of anybody else. And then secondly, we will agree on the difference principle. Now, the difference principle is actually the principle in which, I know this sounds weird, the difference principle is actually his principle of equality, if you can believe that. I'll explain that in a minute. Now, I might just note here as a side observation that there is a very substantial socialist assumption built right into the whole experiment, which is namely the idea that it makes sense even in a thought experiment, to conceive of society as consisting just of a bunch of goods that are unencumbered by ownership. They're just, it's just a bunch of stuff out there, and we'll just devise some rule by which all the stuff that just that's just out there will be distributed to everybody. I mean, basically, it assumes that the national income is not arrived at by adding up the incomes of each individual. It assumes that the national income is like the collectively held income of the collective. But to assume that is really to assume like the most important issue of all. Like this is precisely what you need to defend. You need to argue for that position, and he's just assuming it right at the outset. Well, anyway, that's a slightly technical point I'm sorry for burdening you with. Let's move on and you'll see what the implications of all this are. But let me first explain what the difference principle of Rawls is. The difference principle is his principle of equality, that we need to prefer equality. That is a central ingredient of justice. However, he says, he is not going to insist that every single person has to have exactly the same money income. Because suppose we had that. Suppose everybody, no matter how hard you worked or what job you had, everybody got the same amount of money for in his paycheck. Well, would you work as hard if you knew that no matter how hard you worked, you'd get the same amount? Would you go to all the trouble of going to medical school for years and years and years if you knew that you couldn't keep the money that you earned from medical school, that most of it would be taken away from you to be given to people who haven't done anything? Well, probably you wouldn't. And Rawls says, now that would not help the poor. He says that if our concern here is, the whole point of favoring equality, he says, is that each one of us behind the veil of ignorance would be concerned that maybe we would be the worst, so we want to make the worst the least bad off that we can. Now, if we have a system where everybody gets the same pay, that's going to hurt the poor because nobody's going to want to be a doctor. And so the poor won't get medical care. Nobody would want to be a doctor. Nobody would want to go to the trouble. Nobody would want to be a great inventor. Because all his money is going to be taken away, practically, most of it. And so the poor would lose out on medical care, on great inventions, with people not willing to work as hard. There wouldn't be as much stuff produced, so the poor would get less stuff. He says, so it is okay for people who do excellent work or work really hard to get more pay than other people, because that difference in income benefits the poor. Because the doctor can be somewhat unequal, he's willing to be a doctor. And then the poor get the benefit of medical care. So the poor are benefited by that inequality. So Rawls' view is you can have inequality, but all inequalities have to justify themselves by whether or not they are to the benefit of the least well-off. So the general principle then is we favor equality unless inequality benefits the least well-off among us. That's what he calls the difference principle. Now, some people will say, what if I happen to be a great basketball player? Shouldn't I be able to earn the income that I deserve, that comes to me by dint of my hard work at being a good basketball player? And his answer would be no, because your talent, your skill at basketball is something you got through luck. You don't deserve things that come to you through luck. A great basketball player does not deserve his talent. But it's not just talent, though. You could have talent and never cultivate it. It's also the hard work that went into cultivating and really letting that talent blossom. So what about that? Don't I deserve a little bit more for my hard work? And he would say, no, you don't deserve that, because your willingness to work hard is also luck, that you happen to have that trait. That's also undeserved. Or if your parents encourage you to work hard, that's also undeserved. Now, again, with the difference principle, he would say that maybe you can have a little bit more, but not because you deserve it, but because it benefits the poor if you have a little bit more, because then maybe you're more likely to entertain them with basketball. You see, so you would be entitled to somewhat more. We don't know exactly how much Rawls would allow the basketball player to be unequal, but it's not because of anything that you deserve. You also don't deserve the fact that people like basketball, but you could have a guy who is just as good a chess player as you are a basketball player, but nobody really wants to pay to watch a chess match. And so why should you? You don't deserve the fact that there's a well-developed market for basketball games, that people want to go to basketball games. In what way is it obvious that because my talent came to me by luck, that the government has claim on my talent, or the government is entitled to the fruits of my talent, or that the government can take away what people voluntarily give me because they enjoy the services they get from my talent, from my basketball playing or whatever? It seems like we're making a jump from your talent came to you by luck to the government should be able to take away a lot of your income because that talent came to you by luck. Well, I think you would have to prove that second statement, though it doesn't seem to follow necessarily from the first one. Also, Rawls is strongly discouraging of the idea that we should think in terms of some people as being deserving and other people as being not, when we're engaged in saying, look, we got to take from some people and give to others to establish equality. He does not want to hear anything about these people deserve it more than other people. He says the principles of justice do not mention moral desert, that is, deservingness. And there is no tendency for distributive shares to correspond to it. He goes on to say, the initial endowment of natural assets and the contingencies of their growth and nurture in early life are arbitrary from the moral point of view. So, in other words, morally, it doesn't matter whether you're talented or untalented, but it also doesn't, when it comes down to justice, it doesn't matter if you are a lazy bum, it doesn't matter if you are a wretched human being, or you are an extremely decent person who's struggling to make ends meet. He says, the principles of justice do not mention moral desert. Equality is required for everybody. Remember the exception of the difference principle, but equality is the reigning idea for everybody. It doesn't matter if you're morally deserving or morally undeserving. So in effect, in the reading that I've got for you, in effect, what he's saying is that a mugger who has never worked in his life has to be treated as the moral equal of a single mother who was abandoned by her husband and trying her best to raise several children. We can't say that one deserves the sympathy of society more than the other in terms of equality. They're both entitled to the same consideration in terms of distributing the goods of society to them. Neither one of them is entitled to a larger share of resources. But this is another aspect of the Rawlsian setup that has led some people to dissent from it, because it does seem to at least some people, that the question of moral desert, whether or not the person is deserving, should affect our analysis. It seems a little bit odd that we should say everybody is equally entitled to an equal share of things, no matter what his condition, whether he is working or not working, whether he's a criminal or law-abiding, etc. Now, Robert Nisbet was a great conservative sociologist. I don't know that there were that many of those. Spent his career at Columbia University, mostly at Columbia. And Nisbet asked this. Now, see if you can follow this. It's a little bit technical, but I'm going to read you this passage and see if you can get what he's driving at. He's implying that if Rawls is going to be taken seriously, and if Rawls is going to take his own principles seriously, then he should want to abolish the family. Because after all, so much inequality originates in the family. Because some kids have parents who are very engaged in their lives and very active in their educations, and parents who are very encouraging and provide them with the goods that they need. And there are other kids who have very distant parents, or parents who are not involved or don't care or who aren't loving. So right from the beginning, we have inequality. So if we really cared about equality, then we would be honest enough to say we got to get rid of the family. Now, understand, I am not saying that I support that. That I consider that to be a completely preposterous proposal. I raise it because it seems that if you really believe in equality at a radical level, you would have to abolish the family. And so I think this should be a useful corrective for people who want to go down the equality road. Anything that would lead you to want to abolish the family, I think, should make you think this idea must be screwy. If it's leading me to think that the family needs to be abolished, probably it's a screwy idea. So here's Robert Nisbet. He says, "I have always found treatment of the family to be an excellent indicator of the degree of zeal and authoritarianism, overt or latent, in a moral philosopher or political theorist. Basically, there have been two traditions in Western thought here. In one, reaching from Plato to Rousseau, the family is regarded as an insurmountable barrier to the achievement of absolute virtue or justice in a social order, and therefore is to be obliterated. In the other, reaching from Aristotle to Burke and Tocqueville, the family is declared vital to the achievement and preservation of freedom and order alike in society." So here, Nisbet is saying there are two traditions in philosophy, and one of them is very hostile to the family because the family gets in the way of what the social planners, the planners of society, want to bring about, whether they want to bring about an equal society or they want to educate the kids in their ideas, and the parents are getting in the way because the parents are educating them in the parents' ideas. Whatever the reason is, there is a tradition of political thought that is suspicious of the family. Whereas there's another tradition extending from Aristotle that says, no, the family is really the basic building block of society. Nisbet goes on, "Where does Professor Rawls stand? He is well aware of the social and psychological importance of the family and refers to it in a number of places. Let us take his final reference as indicative. He writes," and now he's quoting from Rawls's book, A Theory of Justice, "The consistent application of the principle of fair opportunity requires us to view persons independently from the influences of their social position. But how far should this tendency be carried?" This is Rawls again, remember. "It seems that when fair opportunity, as it has been defined, is satisfied, the family will lead to unequal chances between individuals. Is the family to be abolished then? Taken by itself and given a certain primacy, the idea of equal opportunity inclines in this direction. But within the context of the theory of justice as a whole, there is much less urgency to take this course." Now back to Nisbet. He says, I am afraid that most readers will take that last, meaning that last part of his statement, as quite unsatisfactory, even as a form of flinching. After all, theory of justice as a whole notwithstanding, there is abundant evidence that the family is among the most powerful generators and reinforcers of inequality in a social order. Rawls knows this very well. He has already proclaimed his willingness to see the factors of motivation, chance, and merit reduced to nullity in behalf of his cherished principle of equality. Can he, in all consistency, long neglect the family, given its demonstrable relation to inequality? So in other words, given that Rawls is willing to say luck, forget about talent, forget about any of this, forget about dessert, forget about it, equality, 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 why wouldn't he be consistent enough to say forget about the family too? Will Professor Rawls in due time find his way to this piece of radical surgery? We can only surmise that he will. Well, he never did. But I think Nisbet is right to note this as an inconsistency in Rawls. Now, the other inconsistency in Rawls comes from the way he treats how countries should treat each other. So individuals, he says, justice demands equality unless inequality benefits the least well off. But in his book, The Law of Peoples, 1999, he says that the difference principle does not apply across countries. Now, first of all, the law of peoples, he's talking about the law of nations. When he uses the word people, he means a country. So like the people of Germany, he's talking about countries when he uses the word peoples in this sense. Now, if he enforced the difference principle across countries, he would basically say that we have to have as much equality in the world as we can. And so clearly, people in the United States live so much better than people in some parts of Africa, for example, that we obviously need to take a lot of the money that people have in the United States and just give it to households in Africa. But he doesn't say that, interestingly. You would think he would. If he believes in equality between individuals, why should it matter where those individuals live on the globe? If one person lives in Africa, or one person lives in Asia, one person lives in the United States, what difference does that make? If we believe in equality, we believe in equality. And yet, he doesn't apply the difference principle across countries, just across individuals. He says, its aim, that is our aim of the aim of assisting poorer countries. He says, we do have an aim, we do have a duty to help poorer countries, but we don't have to be equal with them. We have to help them a little bit. That's basically as far as he goes. We've got to help them a little bit. And the aim of this help is to help burdened societies to be able to manage their own affairs reasonably and rationally, and eventually to become members of the society of well-ordered peoples. This defines the target of assistance. That is, this is what we're aiming for when we help poor countries, just to make them part of the members of the sort of world community. After it is achieved, further assistance is not required, even though the now well-ordered society may still be relatively poor. So he's saying that our responsibility extends only so far as to make sure that the countries of the world are at least reasonably well-organized, and they're organized according to reasonable principles with reasonable efficiency. But beyond that, even if they stay poor, we don't owe them anything else. That's it. Now, it seems, though, that there's an objection we could raise right away, that some countries have resources, right? Some countries have diamond deposits. Some countries have oil. Some countries have minerals. Now, isn't that luck? Remember how Rawls says that you're not allowed to benefit from luck, or at the very least, the government can limit how much you benefit from luck. We can take the stuff you earn that's based on luck, stuff, you know, your talent that you just happen to have. Well, what about a country that just happens to have diamonds? Or a country that just happens to have oil? Shouldn't that mean that we should have a world government that should be able to take the extra income from a country that just by luck happens to have oil? It's not entitled to that oil and the money that it earns from that. It's not entitled to those diamonds and the money that it earns from them. So shouldn't we be taking that extra money from them because they're not entitled to it? Their possession of those things was a matter of luck. He doesn't say that. So inconsistency here. He says, resource-poor countries, that is, countries that don't have minerals or oil or diamonds or whatever, have historically done well. Like, Japan has very few resources, has basically no oil, it's mostly mountainous, etc. And yet Japan has done very well. He says, so there's no need to redistribute resources from resource-rich to resource-poor countries, because a lot of resource-poor countries have done well even though they don't have resources. And he gives us a thought experiment. He says, imagine we have two countries with the same resources, same amount of oil, same amount of diamonds, whatever, and one country pursues sensible economic policies, and the other one pursues stupid, destructive economic policies. He says, the sensible country does not have an obligation to assist the stupid one, the destructive one. Yet what we've just seen Rawls say runs directly counter to what he said in A Theory of Justice. So remember, he said in A Theory of Justice that desert, that is deservingness, does not matter to questions of distributive justice. Distributive justice is the aspect of justice that deals with distributing the resources of society. And we should distribute resources not according to who deserves them and who doesn't, he says. But when he talks about countries, he takes the opposite view. So, for example, we just heard Rawls say that there's no need to redistribute wealth from lucky countries that happen to have a lot of resources to unlucky countries that don't. Because he says, look, a lot of these unlucky countries have done very well for themselves. So we don't need to give, we don't need to take from the lucky and give to the unlucky. But yet he just said, in my example about the basketball player, he just said in The Theory of Justice that we have to take from the lucky person because he didn't deserve his luck, he didn't deserve his talent, and we got to give it to everybody else. Well, why wouldn't that count for countries? Some countries are lucky enough to have resources, some aren't. And yet he doesn't say that the lucky countries have to give up their stuff and give it to the unlucky ones. Likewise, he says, we've got two countries. I just gave you this example. One of them's responsible, one's irresponsible. The responsible one is not obligated to help out the irresponsible one. But he just said, in A Theory of Justice, that we don't think about responsible, irresponsible, moral, and immoral. Everybody's entitled to equality. Remember that? It doesn't matter if you're a struggling single mom or if you're a mugger. Everybody's entitled to equality. It doesn't matter whether you deserve it or not. But he just said countries can deserve it. Countries cannot deserve it. He says a country that does something stupid with its economic policies does not deserve, it's not required that a rich country give them stuff. But yet he just said that individuals are entitled to that. That individuals who are irresponsible are entitled to an equal share of stuff, allowing for the difference principle. Rawls goes on to say, surely there is a point at which people's basic needs, estimated in primary goods, are fulfilled, and a people can stand on its own. Now remember, in this case, people, he means a country. So read that like that. Surely there's a point at which a country's basic needs are fulfilled, and a country can stand on its own. But notice he doesn't say that within societies. He never says, well, once individual persons have enough basic goods, they can stand on their own and you don't have to keep giving them stuff. You don't have to make them absolutely equal. As long as they have enough basic goods, that's okay. No, individuals, he says, they got to be absolutely equal. But then when it comes to countries, he says, well, once they're at least sort of not terrible, that's good enough and we don't owe them anything else. So the question becomes, where's this inconsistency coming from? When he's talking about what you and I owe to other individuals in our society, he's basically saying that if it weren't for the fact that some inequality benefits the poor, we should have to give everything that we have that's greater than the average to the poor. Everything. We would have to be absolutely equal. But then when we get to countries, he does not say that countries have to be absolutely equal and that the rich countries have to divest themselves of a huge amount of their wealth. And so why does he have this inconsistency? And the most persuasive explanation that I've seen is by the philosopher David Gordon. David Gordon says, this is clearly not consistent, right? There's clearly an inconsistency in Rawls. But then the reason he's got it is that he wants a lot of other philosophers and academics to support his theory but they are not going to support his theory if they think it means that they're going to have to turn over 90% of their income to impoverished Asia or Africa. They're just not going to. So according to a theory of justice, well, yeah, they have to probably give a little bit of their income, but they can be unequal because inequality can benefit the poorest for reasons we explained earlier. So they might be willing to go that far. But most people would not be willing to follow Rawls if he said, oh, and by the way, you also owe as much as possible. Like we need to average all the incomes of the whole world. That would mean a severe drop in your standard of living, a severe drop in your income. Most academics, philosophers, whoever, would not be willing to accept that. So Rawls tries to come up with rationales why it makes sense to say, in our country, we have to try to be sort of equal, but we don't have to try to be equal when it comes to other countries. That's sort of inconsistent, but it's because it's the only way he thinks anybody will ever accept his philosophy. Well, that's a theory. We can't know for sure. But there you have John Rawls and egalitarianism. I want you to be aware of this, because when you get into political thought, you're going to hear Rawls, 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 day and night. A theory of justice is sometimes cited as one of the greatest works of political philosophy of all time. Well, you can judge that for yourselves, but I wanted you to be familiar at least with the basic arguments.
All right, everybody, I hope you enjoyed that, and I hope you will forgive me one thing here. First of all, remember, show notes page, tomwoods.com/445. You want to find out more about this topic, as well as how to get the course and how to get your freebies and stuff. That'll all be explained and linked at tomwoods.com/445. But as longtime listeners know, preparing these courses for the Ron Paul curriculum, I mean, I did about 400 videos that I prepared, recorded, edited, uploaded, made reading assignments for, writing assignments for. It took 2 years of my life, and it was extremely difficult, very time-consuming. It was very, very hard work, but I knew it was important. This course basically takes the knowledge that it took me decades to acquire and condenses it into 90 videos. It's an 18-week, half-year course, 5 lessons per week, and it, I think, will save people a lot of time and frustration, because I've done all that time and frustration. I put all that in acquiring this knowledge over the years, but now I'm distilling it for you and giving you the reading assignments and what you would need to really drive this information home in your own head. So what I would like to do then, if I can get your permission, of course, you can always just turn this off, right? Go on to the next episode, but I hope you won't. Because, as I say, this was an enormous amount of work. I want to actually go through the lessons. I want to go through them with you and show you what exactly is covered here. Remember, every fifth lesson, so every Friday lesson, if you're doing them Monday through Friday, is a review of the previous week. Review is a central part of the Ron Paul curriculum because it's so important for retention. If you're getting a whole lot of new knowledge, well, that may seem great, but if you don't remember any of it, what good is it? But review is what pounds it home. So every lesson begins with a review of the previous lesson, and every fifth lesson is a review of the entire week. You really, really find that you retain the stuff much, much better. So I won't go over the review lessons. I've already told you that that's one-fifth of the course. But I start off with an introduction, giving people an overview of what they can expect. Then 3 lessons on the history of natural rights theories from the High Middle Ages to the present. Then a lesson on Lysander Spooner and the idea of consent. Do we really give our consent to government? I talk about Robert Nozick's The Tale of the Slave, which is a stirring presentation about how free we really are. I talk about human rights and property rights, what these terms mean, and are they different or are they the same? Negative rights and positive rights is a very important distinction for people to understand. Then I spend a whole week on critics of liberalism, that is, critics of classical liberalism, critics of libertarianism. So I talk about Jean-Jacques Rousseau. I talk about John Rawls, a more modern thinker. This is the lesson from today, of course. Then I talk about Ronald Dworkin and Thomas Nagel. I talk about a famous Marxist, G.A. Cohen. Then I have a section on rationales that have traditionally been given for government action. So public goods, You need the government to supply public goods, or to raise the standard of living, or to conquer poverty, or to fight against monopoly, or to fund science, or to fight inequality, or to provide development aid to the third world, or to battle discrimination, and so on. So that stuff is covered in a special section. Then I've got a big series of lessons called Some Problems with Government Action. I begin by explaining what Mises talked about, the socialist calculation problem. I talk about working conditions. Can government improve working conditions? What about child labor? What about labor unions? Health care, antitrust, farm programs, war and the economy. Business cycles. Industrial policy. This was very popular in the 1980s, making a bit of a comeback now. Government, the market, and the environment is the subject of yet another lesson. Then prohibition, whether of alcohol or drugs. Taxation, I have a lesson on that, a lesson on government spending. Two lessons on the welfare state, theory and practice. A lesson on price controls, two lessons on government and money, and then a review of what has been covered up to now. Then a unit on the modern state, the theory of the modern state. American federalism and the compact theory. Can political bodies be too large? Then a lesson on decentralization. Then I have a series of lessons on comparative systems, so comparative systems of government. So first we talk about constitutionalism. We talk about the American case. We talk about to the 10th Amendment and self-government. We talk about progressives and their idea of the Constitution as being a living, breathing document. I have a lesson on the American states and the federal government. Then we talk about monarchy, social democracy, Sweden, for example, two lessons on fascism, two lessons on Marxism, two lessons on communism, a lesson on post-war Africa as a miscellaneous example of interventionism, then two lessons on public choice, which is a field that I think you'll find interesting. Then a lesson, miscellaneous examples of government activity and incentives. Then a unit on the lessons of history, and because usually we draw the wrong lessons from history. So I've got the Industrial Revolution, two lessons on the New Deal, and then a lesson on the housing bust of 2008. Then a unit on unresolved problems. First, are voters informed? Is political representation meaningful? The myth of the rule of law, and the incentives of democracy. Then, to conclude, the concluding lessons, I talk about Robert Lefebvre, a guy you may not know of, but who was a great libertarian theorist about a half century ago. Then I introduce students to Murray Rothbard and his critique of the state. I do a case study. We look at the Old West, which has been completely misunderstood as a historical episode. Then we conclude with a lesson on the economic freedom of the world. Is there a correlation between economic freedom and prosperity? And then finally, Lecture 90, what have we learned? So, I hope you find that interesting. And if you're interested in getting that course, tomwoods.com/445 will give you all the different ways to get it. Thanks for listening.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.